We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly chess interview show where we talk with accomplished chess players, authors, and personalities about their lives, their careers, and how to improve at chess. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters and by Chessable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We are joined this week by an author, a trainer, and accomplished chess player. He's won several international tournaments, competed with the Croatian national team, was even on a Croatian chess television show, as we will discuss. These days, he works most as a trainer and author. He has trained the Finland's men's and women's team. He previously coached in Dubai, and he's written two books. His first book, Beyond Material, in 2019, was mentioned as one of the best in recent memory by John Hartman here on this very podcast. And he's out with a new book that as soon as I saw it, I knew I had to interview him. It's called How to Study Chess on Your Own, Creating a Plan That Works and Sticking to It. Brand new from New in Chess. I finished the book yesterday, as luck would have it. And it's incredible. It's it's like drinking from a fire hose, a huge treasure trove of information for titled players and improvers alike. So I'm super excited to pick his brain about chess improvement and hear about his career. So let's welcome him to the show. Davorin Kozyasevic, how are you, Davorin?
Doing pretty well, thanks.
So, as I said, I've been reading this book, Beyond Material. I've had for a while and looked through it, but not read it completely. But this new book, there's just so much to talk about in terms of actionable advice for club players. So why don't we begin, Davorin, by you just sort of telling us, I know you mentioned in the book that you have lots of ideas for books. So how did you settle on this particular idea?
Yeah, basically the book is like a long answer to the question that a lot of my students have asked me, you know, from time to time, or just me hearing people, chess players say and talk about, this issue of studying on your own. There's no such clear guidelines. Because if you have, let's say, a coach or a book, you get these guidelines. Yeah, solve these puzzles or do this kind of training, analyze with someone else. But actually, when you're on your own, it's not that straightforward. Yeah. So my idea was to create a book where it would be quite a comprehensive overview of study methods, study resources. There is also, of course, an introductory chapter on study mindset, so that you actually study the right way. Okay, I talked about different areas of the game, you know, like how to study openings, middle games, end games, and so on. And I provided some tools to create your own study plans. This was one of the bigger ideas because I've used some of these tools myself, and I wanted to share them, basically.
Yeah, I mean, and we'll talk about that for sure, because you get into these hardcore study plans that you've used in your own life. Becoming a grandmaster, of course, does require a lot of work, as your book makes clear. And one thing I want to mention right off the top, because I knew when I saw this book, a lot of listeners would be interested in it. It's still not available as we record in paper form. You can order it, but haven't received it yet. But it is available on Kindle, where I read it, and on the New in Chess Readers app. So lots of ways. And of course, I'm a big fan of that app because you can just play through the moves without setting up a chess set. Something we may discuss, the efficacy of that. But in any event, I did want to mention it's not just this is how you study. There's tons of instructional material in it. So when you structured the book, how did you decide sort of how much instructive chess material to include and how much to just have it be like a how-to guide?
Well, I think one thing, if you read the book, you might get, but actually I mentioned this in the preface of the book. The idea is to develop a couple of things. So, and this is this how-to part. So to develop independence in your studies, to develop or to learn how to structure your studies. And thirdly, to try to prefer deeper study methods as opposed to more superficial ones. So, you know, if you read between the lines, you probably get these messages. And of course, there has to be some instructive material because you need to see, let's say, how to study, how to memorize a certain type of material, yeah, or how to do simulations. This is one of my favorite study methods where you take a game and you just go through it from start to finish and you try to guess the moves, yeah. But you are fully in this competitive mode. You're pretending like you're playing a game, and all these you know, study ideas and study methods, I needed to include some illustrations, right? And so I tried to find that kind of mix.
Yeah, and it's a good job. I mean, the instructive material itself is serious stuff. I mean, so for listeners, I would say you'll benefit most if you're rated over 1800 in terms of the chess instruction part. But the lessons, of course, are universal, and you have study plans for players of all levels, including lower rated. Now, of course, this is a long book with lots of great material in it. Readers would really get their money's worth, but I did want to kind of highlight a few themes from it, Devrin. So one of them is the age-old question of adult improvement itself. So you tell a story in the book from a FIDE trainer's seminar where that topic comes up. Do you mind retelling that for our listeners?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was at the FIDE trainer seminar in Dubai, and Eustratios Grivas, the lecturer, grandmaster, he was asking the question, you know, why do adult players find it more difficult to improve than younger players? And okay, there were different suggestions, like they don't have enough time, which actually, okay, it's probably true as well. You know, they cannot study as efficiently as young people. I guess there is some truth to that too. But then he said, okay, but actually older or adults have too many opinions. So he was trying to say that, you know, if you have too many opinions, then you're not letting the new knowledge come in, yeah? You are maybe too set in your old ways, both studying and playing. And when something new comes across, you try to incorporate it into your old sort of paradigm, yeah? How you understand chess, instead of trying to create new paradigms. And so I think it's much more effective. Of course, we have to have some things that we believe in, yeah, but it's much more effective if you're kind of open to new knowledge, to new ways.
So you agree with Grandmaster Grievous's assessment of what the main cause is?
No, I mean, I can see it with myself. I'm not sure if it's the main cause, but I think there is a lot of truth to it.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I personally do not think it's the main cause. I think that, I mean, obviously we've talked about this a lot. I have with various guests on the podcast. I think that time constraints and just slower assimilation of patterns probably are bigger, but I definitely get what he's saying about often you have a bad idea and it's better if you have sort of a fresh slate, or it would be if you could just erase the bad idea you had. Like I've heard when conversations come up about, like, you know, someone like Lawrence Trent wants to make a bet about if he can become a grandmaster, or some player who's 1600 will want to make a bet, can I make master in some number of years? And I've heard strong players like yourself, Davern, say like they might be better off if they were starting from scratch, because then they could hire a trainer, the trainer could tell them what really matters, and they wouldn't have these bad habits to get rid of.
Well, I mean, you can always do it, yeah? Even if you're, let's take example of Lawrence, yeah? So he wants to become a GM. I mean, if he put in the time, he hired the trainers and all that, I think he could do it. If he just kind of maybe had this fresh start in his mind. But you have to be very committed, yeah? And you have to put in the time. And he's right now, he's like a broadcaster and he has all these other things going on. Of course, it's going to take a lot of time to actually do something else, yeah?
Yeah. And again, reading your study plan, reading some of the plans that you've enacted, you're not just like brainstorming, you've done them. Definitely could be sobering for some people. Could you walk us through? So you talk about one period in particular where you kind of hit a plateau and felt like you needed to improve your calculation training. Could you walk us through what you did to break through that and just the amount of hours that were involved?
Yes. This was, okay, I was already a GM, I think in 2013. And okay, let's say I had like good technique, more or less, but I had some issues with playing dynamic positions. Not maybe calculation per se, but just when the position would enter this dynamic phase with a lot of, you know, threats and tactics and all that, I was kind of not really feeling that confident there. I was making mistakes both in when I was a stronger side and a weaker side. And I remember there was particularly one game against Daniel Friedman where, okay, I caught him in the opening, and then I had just a huge attack. His king was on f8, and I just kept, move by move, I kept giving up my advantage, and in the end, it was a draw. But I should have won in many ways. And then I said, okay, it's enough. I really need to fix this part of my game. And I was actually talking about this in the chapter on tactics training, where a very common mistake when you see that you maybe should do some more tactics training is to focus on solving puzzles. And this is just one part of the tactics training. It's necessary, but you actually have to go wider. And so the kind of training that I did was involved analyzing a lot of double-edged positions, doing, as I said, simulations of games of players with a sharp style like Richard Rapport and many older players like Judit Polgar and Topalov and so on. I solved a lot of studies and problems blindfold, because I think blindfold is excellent to improve your tactical skills. And so I did this for 2 months straight. I didn't miss a day of study, and I did it for, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 hours a day, depending on the day. And so after that, in my next tournament, I really felt a huge improvement in terms of my, it kind of sinked in. I didn't even play technical chess that much as I wanted to create something on the board. I always wanted to create something tactical, dynamic.
Yeah, just an amazing story, an amazing dedication. And as you say, of course, you're a chess professional and you were already a grandmaster at that time. Now, these days, of course, I mean, you're still a chess professional, but you're also, your wife is one of the top players in Bulgaria. And now you have a little kid, if I'm correct. Is that right, Davern?
Yes.
Yeah. So how does that change things for you? I mean, because that was one thing that as a working dad reading the book struck me, is just the number of hours was just that often were advocated were just so daunting that it made me, it almost felt futile for me to try to get better at chess.
Actually, I got an email from a reader recently who probably also read the book in Forward Chess or Kindle. And he was telling me, okay, like your book is nice and everything, but this is just too, like you're advocating too much study. But I don't think it should be like the tables there that and the study plans that I provide, they shouldn't be taken literally. Like sometimes I provide some of my old study plans where I studied for, you know, 4 or 5, 6 hours a day, but you can adjust this. Basically, it's just a tool for you to apply to your own situation. So let's say that you have, I don't know, an hour a day, for instance, or you have a couple of more hours over the weekend. So you just use the same kinds of study, you know, planning tools, schedules, and create your own study plan based on that.
Yeah, that's good advice for sure. And listeners always want to know like the study breakdown, and you did provide that in the book. Of course, it's going to be slightly different for different levels and different people who have different strengths and weaknesses. But your overall guidance was 10% openings, 25% tactics, 25% middle end games, 20% middle games, and 20% general improvement. So first of all, so two things struck me about that. Number one, of course, we often have the debate here on the show about how much to study openings, and that's pretty low on the guideline spectrum. And number two, I'm sure listeners would like to hear what you mean. Obviously, you talk about it in the book, but what you mean by general improvement time.
Okay, so this breakdown that I provided, it's for improving players, like let's say below 1800, yeah. Mm-hmm. Their openings are really not that important. I mean, you have to have your systems and all, but really you would benefit more if you studied all of the other areas of the game, especially endgames and tactics, where most mistakes are made. And it's an approximate breakdown, really. I mean, you can do 20% or 25% of openings, but if you see that things are not working for you and that you have some issue, let's say, playing endgames, okay, you can tone it down and study more endgames than openings. So the whole book, I just want to say this, you shouldn't take things too literally from it. Yeah, I really want to provide the guidelines, not necessarily the complete blueprint of how to do it. And now, general improvement that you asked, it includes several topics. So first of all, it's improvement. Like let's say reading books like Pump Up Your Rating by Axel Smith, or hiring a coach to help you. Work on your area, you know, improvement of certain areas, maybe psychological aspects of your play. It includes analyzing your games. It includes reading good books like tournament or game collections of strong players. So it's basically everything that doesn't belong into our typical opening, middle game, end game breakdown. But maybe it includes parts of all of these areas of chess.
Okay, yeah, that's good advice for sure. So you mentioned that obviously for club players, especially below 1800, there often can be an overemphasis on openings. But of course, at your level, you're studying them, probably the bulk of your time, or at least it's not uncommon for grandmasters to spend their bulk of the time studying openings and, of course, the structures that arise from them as well. What about in between? What about players, say, 2,000 to 2,300? I mean, again, I know it's to your credit in the book. You give detailed study plans for different levels, but how would you adjust if you're in between those levels?
So that would be in between 2,000 and 2,300, let's say.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I have a lot of students in that range, and I think it's definitely, let's say, if I would have to say percentage, you know, at least 25%, maybe more. But the opening study should be very closely related to middle game study. So like you mentioned, studying structures, studying different, even end games you can study, you know, typical end games that can arise from the opening. There is a really good book. I mentioned it in the resources in my book by John Cox. I think it's called Berlin Wall, where he breaks down typical endgame structures that happen in the Berlin endgame, you know, Berlin, the variation of the Spanish opening. So I think, you know, in, at that level, over 2000, it's not just, you know, learning some variations that you might get, but you should really get deep into middle games when you study an opening.
Yeah, I agree. And you recommend the John Cox books and lots of other good recommendations for listeners looking for book recommendations. Even as I mentioned to you before we're recording, I was impressed that you're aware of good literature, not just for people at your level, but people sort of across the reading spectrum. So we've got a bunch of good questions from Patreon subscribers of the podcast. Shout out to a longtime listener and friend of the show, Peter Newhall, who sent in a few good questions. Peter's been very dedicated to chess improvement over the years, but he's a working dad like you and I, and he's always looking for the right study plan. So he was one of the people I thought of as someone who would be excited to read this book. And sure enough, Peter has already ordered it, although not read it yet. So this is what Peter, this is question number one. We've got a few. We'll just tackle them one by one. So Peter asks, do you feel that there's a minimum amount of playing and studying one really ought to do to improve reading-wise at various levels, specifically for him, 2000 or 2200?
Minimum, yeah. Well, okay, it's hard to tell, but maybe if the higher rating, the more you have to study, obviously, to improve. But let's say if you're closer to 2200, probably 2 hours a day is the minimum, I would say.
Wow. I better free up some time.
Well, I do not want to discourage anyone. It's very individual, right? So you should make the best of the time that you have.
Yeah.
Because why I'm saying this, because there's a lot of kids, yeah, who are rated maybe even below 2000. And you will play, when you go to a tournament, you're going to play a couple of them, right? And they study a lot because yeah. of time. So you have to somehow keep up with them. Experience is on your side, you know, the intuition about different chess parts of chess game is on your side, but they have the times to catch up with you, so you have to catch up with them in a way. You cannot probably, if you have like 1 hour a day or something, I'm not sure if that's enough, really.
Yeah, and to be clear, even though I say you know, it sounds daunting and I react in that way, but I don't disagree, because my experience has been, I've been probably doing like 45 minutes to an hour a day, and it definitely doesn't feel like enough.
But okay, if you have a long, and this is something I mentioned in the book, or I stress in the book, if you have a long-term attitude or mindset where you're not really trying to achieve some rating goal within, you know, like 3 months or two tournaments, but you're looking, you know, within maybe a year to improve your rating and your strength, obviously. This is a better approach than just chasing some results, you know. And so if you have a limited study time, I think it's better to extend this horizon, you know, where you want to achieve something. I mean, I talk about it also in the book. So for people with limited study time, I think that's what I would recommend. Focus on some of the areas that you feel you need to improve, like the key study areas, and extend your, horizon of your study goals. And let's say maybe over 6 months or a year, you will actually feel improvement. You have a limited time, but if you do it for a longer time,
excellent advice. Yeah. And shout out to a friend of the show and habit grandmaster, Neil Bruce, who says that, because he's a working dad as well and finds more time than a lot of people, but he's always advocating like, don't beat yourself up. And, you know, if you have a hectic day and you only do 10 minutes of chess, you know, celebrate the fact that you did 10 minutes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Make the most out of the time that you do have. And if you set up a good study plan in advance, then you will know, okay, today I have only 30 minutes. And in that 30 minutes, I'm going to make the most of my time. Yeah. I'm going to try to make sure that this counts for my long-term improvement.
Yeah. And could you expand about that on that a little bit? Because that's a major theme in your book, the importance of having a plan in advance.
Yes. So you start basically by identifying your key study areas. So those that you feel like, and you can analyze your games, or you can ask a coach to analyze or identify these study areas for you. Let's say, Ben, what do you feel it's like your weaker area of your game?
I would say from my rating calculation.
Calculation. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the planet I mentioned earlier, it could work for you, I think. So you set up some sort of a plan where you have four or five study activities, but you're focused on calculation. You're not browsing through some random games, or you're not studying end games or anything else too much. And let's say you spend 50% to I don't know, 75% of your time on that particular area. You come up with, like I said, study activities. You come up with study resources. So what you're going to study. So it's not like, oh, look, there is a great new book by, I know, Cyrus Lagdawala, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
So I have to get it, and then you wait like 2 months to get it, and then, okay, then I'm going to start my training. Okay, I mean, you can study with, I mentioned this in the book, you can have limited resources, but still do, like, make good studies. So you just figure out your resources and your activities in advance. You make a plan. You come up with a schedule, like I said, when are you available, on which days, how much you can study, and you try to fit in these slots like that you have. I like to do it on a weekly basis. Fit these study activities into slots, and it becomes meaningful because I know, you know, it's getting me toward my goal if I work on them.
Yeah, great advice, and you know, this sort of goes hand in hand with Peter Newhall's next question. So Peter's question is, how do you recommend adult improvers focus on progress? It's one thing to design an inspiring and well-rounded study plan, yet it's an entirely different thing to stick with it week in and week out, to just check off boxes on a homemade spreadsheet for seemingly arbitrary tasks.
Well, okay, the latter part of the question sounds a bit like you're doing it because you have to. I mean, you should.
Yeah. Or maybe he's not, again, Peter, as a working dad, I think he has three kids. So it could be that he's not playing enough, you know, like sometimes you need that motivation where like you're playing so that you actually feel like this is what I'm working for, you know?
Yeah. Okay. This is going to be some like small digression, but I just want to say playing, I mentioned this in the book, playing and studying are very important as to do them together. So because a positive feedback loop forms where you know, playing helps you study better and studying helps you play better. So even while you study, you know, you can play. You can play sparring games. You can play Blitz. I think Blitz is a very good study tool. Rapid, of course, as well. If you have time, you can play against the computer. So you should add this element of playing as much as you can in your studies because it's more fun that way. There is the learning part, there is the decision-making part, and there is the playing part that you can incorporate in your training. But okay, coming back to the original question, I think if you have big enough goals that you really care about, it can be a rating goal. It can be to achieve certain, you know, to learn a new opening or to win in your club championship. Okay. It really depends what you care about. I don't know. But I gave this story in the book where when I was very young, I was just starting out basically, and I won a Croatian national championship for kids, I think under 10 or something. And it was my first experience playing the World Youth Championship. And as any kid, I wanted to win, yeah?
Yeah.
And I was maybe rated, I don't know, 1,700 at the time. And, you know, you had these big guns like Rajabov and Gashimov and Huseinov and all these people, you know, rated already like 2,300. But I wanted to win because what does a kid know, yeah? And so, okay, I was always like at the 50% in these tournaments for a long time. But I kept having this dream, you know, like every year I go there, I want to win. And so at some point when I really improved, I was kind of close to it. Actually, not really, but I finished fourth. And this was, I was happy with this result. I never won it. But I think the bottom line is that this big goal always helped me. Like I had it in the back of my mind and I always wanted to improve because of that. I always wanted to study more. I was very motivated to study at that time when I was, you know, at the scholastic level.
Yeah.
And so I think if you have a big enough goal, Now, it's, I understand it's a bit hard when you're a working person and you cannot really think about chess all that much. But still, I think you can set up some meaningful goals and study activities that come from them.
Yeah, good advice there. And Peter's next question also is sort of along the same lines, because I think often, like in Peter's case and my case for that matter, getting to tournaments can be the biggest struggle. So Peter asks, he says, I've never found any kind of consistent training partner as an adult. Finding a good match and then scheduling logistics makes it very sporadic and discouraging. Are there any engines, i.e. Magnus H10, Stockfish 13, set to some lower level that you feel can be good training partners for playing longer games? Or is there some other replacement that you might recommend?
Maybe that's like two questions in one. One is about because these are different types of, I would say, study methods, playing against a human and against a computer. There are differences.
So even if the computer is like designed to be weaker, you still feel like it's not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're playing a computer; it's not the same, and you cannot discuss it later with the computer. With the human, you can.
Yeah.
In the game, but no. Of course, there are options when we talk about computer. I think on chess.com there are these lower rated bots, and they're sorted by levels, like from beginner to master level. And they have personalities, like you can play different against different playing styles. So I think that isn't too difficult to arrange. In terms of playing against humans, so yeah, logistics are sometimes tricky. I don't know how it works. Like if you go to a website and you seek like a game 30 or game 20, I mean, how big is the pool?
From what I've heard, I've never done that, but from what I've heard, it's pretty challenging, especially I think anything over 15.
Okay.
I mean, of course, there are Discord servers like Chess Dojo, and there are other improver servers where you can try to find someone around your level. But as Peter says, often like trying to arrange that takes time, the precious time that you could actually be studying, you know?
I completely understand, yeah. Or maybe it's possible to join some groups, like let's say on chess.com. Maybe there are some groups with like-minded people who would like to play training games.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.
I think it should be a solvable problem in this day and age. And we've got one more chess improvement Patreon question, and then a couple more topics on the book, Devern, and then I'd like to discuss your other book and a few other things. So this one is from adult improver Vishnu Srikumar, who of course was a popular guest on episode 215. For anyone who has not heard it, I recommend it. Vishnu, very hardworking chess improver. He says, I'm a 35-year-old amateur chess player who put in 2 to 3 hours a day for 1 to 1.5 years, over which time I gained 300 rating points from 1650 to 1950. But now I have a lot less time, about 1 hour per day during the week, to work on chess, and time for one classical training game during the weekend. Do you have any suggestions for how to streamline my chess study other than to buy my book, which Vishnu says he intends to?
So I think I mentioned this before, probably focusing on certain areas that you feel like if you improve those areas, your overall game will improve. I think that's very important, and then focus most of your time there. And like I mentioned, don't have such short-term goals, but rather think in long-term and try to spread out, whatever you're studying over a longer period of time.
Okay, yeah, excellent advice. A couple other themes from the book that I thought listeners could benefit from. One, you had an interesting discussion of the idea of engines inhibiting growth, and you told a story from your own experiences. Could you share your opinions on that topic?
Yeah, these days I like working with engines quite a lot. There are different types of engines. I mean, now we have Leela, which is different compared to Stockfish, but I think it's very important to work with them at the very end of whatever you're doing, whether you're analyzing a game, playing a game, analyzing with another person or whatever, or just trying to find the best move in the position, you always should do it. And I wrote recently an article for the New In Chess magazine about that. You always should use your mind first. And then use the engine as sort of a check, you know, something that will check your thoughts. And it will show you sometimes, you know, where you made the mistake, maybe show some interesting research that you never had in mind, and just make you like more tactically precise. So I think that's the right way to use the engine. I know there are some people who are kind of opposed to using the engine completely, but I think you're taking away from your learning experience that way, because engine, you know, working with engines can teach you a lot. You just have to know how to use them.
Yeah. I mean, despite the fact that some grandmasters and title players on the show have recommended not using engines at all, I think that, as you alluded to in the book, a far more common problem is just kind of being a slave to the engine.
This happens with young players a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's very easy to turn on the engine, especially when you play the game and you're, okay, I made a mistake here and case closed. Yeah, next time I'll play better. But then you don't analyze your game. You don't learn anything from that. So I think it's actually, this advice is fairly simple, but okay, maybe more difficult to follow for some people.
Yeah, Garry Kasparov was recently on James Altucher's podcast. I actually linked to this on Twitter because there was a lot of interesting stuff in there, and I'll link to the interview in the show notes. But one thing he said was that he felt that one edge that Magnus had over other elite players, from what he's observed, is that Magnus is one of the few people who can use the engine without letting it hijack his brain.
Yeah, okay, but these people are on a completely different level from you and
yeah,
me.
Yeah, they are.
I don't know. But absolutely, yeah. I do talk about this in the book a little bit, that you can sometimes even analyze with the engine working, you know, like in parallel on your computer, but you have to make sure that it doesn't guide your thought process. I think even Boris Gelfand talked about this on your show, that, you know, you can think and you can come up with an idea and then give it to the engine, and engine will show you some resources, and then you see what it gives you, and then you can keep on analyzing, but you're providing the ideas, yeah? This is
yeah.
The key. But this is, yeah, more, this is more difficult for younger players, I think.
Mm-hmm. And probably it's more difficult for lower rated
players. And for lower rated as well.
Yeah. Yes. But you give some good examples in the book where you walk through how you work with an engine where you would not just use its suggestion, but give suggestions and then watch it react to them. I also thought the insight you shared about like the engine being forward looking is important for people to be aware of, or at least to be more aware of. So could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, basically the number that you see on the screen, like some position being, I don't know, 1.0 or something, it's the number that the engine, or the evaluation that the engine gives at the end of the line it calculates. So let's say that it's plight 30, yeah? Plight 30 means that it calculates 15 moves ahead, I believe. So the engine sees some position 50 moves ahead that you have no way of imagining even, and it bases its evaluation 1.0 on that position, yeah? After the best moves by both sides. So you have to understand that in some positions, it's simply impossible for you to understand why the engine gives this evaluation, even though the objectively it may be that way. So this is why you have to use your own mind. You know, you have to try to understand the position yourself, not just blindly trust what the engine gives.
Yeah, and as we've mentioned before on the podcast, particularly for club players, like the difference in like 0.2 of a pawn, it's borderline irrelevant for a lot of players. If you're much better off just basing your judgment on the playability of the position and yes, whether or not you understand the plans. Obviously, when you start to reach your level, Davern, that may not be the case anymore. So I want to talk about Beyond Material as well as about what's going on with your life and career, Davern. But first, let's take a break and hear from our friends at Chessable.com. This is your weekly reminder that Chessable.com has a ton of high-quality material. Whether you're looking to learn a certain opening Want to see the latest Super GM repertoire that has been published? Want to find a tactics course appropriate for your level? Whatever it may be, go to chessable.com and have a look around. Don't forget they have tons of cool free content too, like their short and sweet courses about various openings. And all of the things that they offer feature their proprietary move trainer technology, the secret sauce that lets you actually remember all of the new chess moves and opening sequences that you learn. So once again, chessable.com, check out their ever-expanding excellent library. So Dobrin, Beyond Material also has gotten a lot of rave reviews. And as I mentioned in the intro, I bought the ebook a while ago, but I've only had a chance to leaf through it, even though speaking of weaknesses of mine, like a lot of non-titled players, I think I struggle with materialism. I struggle with not being willing to sacrifice. One thing you mentioned, of course, is the lessons we can learn from AlphaZero and Game Changer. So why don't we start with that sort of overview? What can we learn from that? And how can even people who are not, you know, AlphaZero apply that to their games?
Okay, first you can start by looking at these games. I think they're available only in the book Game Changer. But they're very, I think, insightful in that way. And I think the author, Matthew Sadler, explains them, you know, very well, very in a lot of detail, you know, how this kind of decision by AlphaZero can be applied on a human level. So I think just going through these games, I think even for people who are not title players or anything, you can understand where that engine is coming from. And one, I think, big takeaway from that book, at least that I got, is that this type of engine, like, it's more like for a human, it's more intuitive how it makes decisions compared to, let's say, Stockfish, which is more materialistic, right? And AlphaZero just goes for these things that we value more, like initiative, some, you know, positional outpost or a nice maneuver with the knight. And this is what I talk about in the book, Beyond Material, because the point is to value non-material factors like positional factors, time, meaning, you know, tempo, initiative, attack, and psychological factors as well, to understand how they can be sometimes even more important than material. Because material is something that we kind of, it's like the comfort zone, yeah? You win material, it usually means you're well off, and you lose material, it usually means it's bad for you. But there are these gray areas, right? And this is where I go with Beyond Material. So you go beyond these areas and you try to understand, okay, when is it good to and, you know, sacrifice may not even be the right word. I would say exchange material for other factors. And let's say one particular example that I like in that book is a game between Artemiev and Motilev, where Artemiev sacrificed, you know, there is this bishop h4 pin on the knight on f6, so black plays g5, and he sacrifices a knight. Knight takes g5, h takes g5, bishop takes g5. A classical sacrifice, but actually it doesn't even quite work in the position tactically, but he still sacrifices it, and he wins the game because he put a huge psychological pressure on Motilev. Because you can see that Motilev was spending a lot of time trying to come up with something, and he was playing well, and in one moment he just collapsed. Yeah, so it's clear it's psychological pressure. We exchanged material for psychological advantage.
Yeah, I remember that example. Again, I haven't read the whole book, but I did look through that, and it was interesting. Yeah, how he just had sort of long-term unpleasantness, you know?
Yes,
like,
exactly.
No concrete knockout blow, but you wouldn't want to be sitting there as black in that position.
I mean, I felt it in my games too. Like somebody just goes all out and it's very uncomfortable, yeah?
Yeah. So just out of curiosity, I mean, how do you think Artemiev's mindset might be for something like that? Like, he obviously calculates better than any of us, but so does he just reach a point where he says it's good enough, or do you think how do you think he would approach it and be willing to play something like that?
Yeah, he probably sees it's not losing outright, yeah, and he sees some variations where he might maybe there's some trick in some variation, or he just has a long term. I think that's a very key word that you mentioned, long term initiative, right? So it's not like it's refutable immediately, and it provides some other types of advantages, like I mentioned. And I think the whole theme in the book is that all of these sacrifices that are examined are long-term sacrifices. So no, it's not something like, you know, like a five-move combination, and you know, at the end of it, you're getting your material back with, you know, with interest or something. It's actually, these are, like I said, gray areas. Sometimes the sacrifices are semi-correct or incorrect.
Yeah, and obviously, as you mentioned, you work with a lot of 2,000 to 2,300 rated players. So I'm sure you see this problem a lot. Obviously, I'm sure you suggest they read beyond material, which is a good suggestion.
I never suggest my students to read my book.
Oh, you got to get on that. You got to sell some books, Stavros.
No, because I show the material from the book sometimes. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. But do you have any drills you recommend, or would you have someone play like some dodgy or gambit type opening, or is there anything else people can do to kind of sort of break the shell?
Okay, I'm not sure if I would recommend just completely going, you know, all in like that, start playing gambits. Okay, actually, it's a good suggestion for players who start out at chess, beginners and post-beginners, to play gambits, because they learn the value of time in chess. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you think about it, if we go to chess history, I mean, this is the way it kind of progressed in the 19th century. Time was valued more than material. And then after that, in the early 20th century, positional factors were valued a lot, right? You know, with Botvinnik and all these people, and now in our computer modern era, material matters the most. But who knows? Maybe there will be a new era where we'll get something else. But coming back to the methods, so I think just studying, and we can relate this to my new book, How to Study, right? You need to create a comprehensive plan of, you know, if you want to get better at that area in particular. Come up with certain methods that you think will help you. Yeah, so maybe studying some very good examples of double-edged play with sacrifices. This is, I think, a good starting point.
Yeah. And again, there's plenty of material to study in the book. You can also, you know, if you Google positional sacrifice or something, you'll find plenty of YouTube videos and stuff.
Yeah, I mean,
there
are books on that. I mean, there is a book by a Dutch author, Positional Sacrifices.
Yeah, pretty new, yeah.
And so on. There's I mean, last 2 years, there have been more books, I mean, issued than in the last, I don't know, 10 years. Because of
And you're pretty on top of them. Hearing you walk through the sort of evolution of chess made me think that, reminded me that you mentioned an enthusiasm for I Am Willy Hendricks books, which I share with you.
I haven't actually read them, but I have read parts of them. Like, I didn't read the full books, but yeah, I mean, the ideas that he shares there are pretty original, and I definitely agree with them.
Yeah, those books are On the Origin of Good Moves is the new one, and older one was Move First, Think
Move
Later.
Think Later,
and he's been on the podcast as well. So great advice all around, Davern. I want to get into your own professional and family life, but first we're going to take a break and hear from aimchess.com. Not every chess player has a janitor to help them improve at chess like Beth Harmon did. For those of you who don't, there is aimchess.com. Aimchess has a web-based algorithm that collects and analyzes your games from chess.com or LeeChess, and then it creates personalized study plans based on your weaknesses to help you improve. It might highlight specific openings to work on, tell you to tighten up your tactics, or in my case, tell me to manage my time better. Then it gives you puzzles and advice with the goal of helping you improve your chess faster. You can check out Aim Chess for free. And then if you decide to subscribe, please use the promo code CHESS30 to save 30%. That's CHESS30. The details are also in the show notes. So for now, let's get back to the interview. So Davern, reading this book and reading about your huge ambition. I mean, I would describe this as an ambitious book in terms of the amount of material that it covers and the amount of sort of actionable suggestions it has, and even just the sheer amount of educational content within the book itself. I read this book in about 9 days, but I think done properly, one could spend 3 months on this. Obviously, I didn't, when it came to the instructive chess material, in order to read all the thoughts, I had to go faster than I otherwise would have. But seeing this extremely professional approach both to your training and your own chess development made me wonder what you're up to these days and how you're balancing your competing with your family and your career.
Well, okay, I'm not competing at all, so this is one thing less to worry about. But yeah, it's sometimes a bit challenging, with a little kid. But I think we're balancing well. I'm mostly coaching. I'm also, of course, writing a lot of material, educational material, and doing online lectures and things like that. So I think, especially since now there is no temptation, there's not that many tournaments, so there's no temptation
right.
to play it too much. I think it's all right in that respect.
Because your wife, WGM, apologies if I mispronounce it, but WGM Eva Vidanova,
yes.
She, from what I can tell, she still plays a lot of league games, and obviously she's one of the top players in Bulgaria where you live. So is she competing more than you are, or is it just the pandemic has kind of put everything down?
Not anymore, yeah.
Okay.
And I think she has a greater will to play than me. I'm almost kind of retired, but... league games, of course, like if they pop up from time to time, it's easy, right, to organize. But yeah, to have some big plan, like, you know, to play three tournaments in a row or something, that I think would be too much at this stage.
Yeah, it totally makes sense, especially again seeing like how seriously you took it. You pushed so hard that I can see now at this stage of your life how that might be a bit more challenging. But let's make it a hypothetical, Devon. I mean, I have some ideas from reading the book, of course, but if you were going to get back into it and decide, you know what, I'm going to play three tournaments in the next 3 months, like what would you do in terms of a study regimen, and what would be realistic for you personally with all these other responsibilities?
Yeah, I think if I had enough time to study maybe 3 or 4 hours a day, probably I'd look at a lot of openings, because I didn't study openings that much lately. And probably go back to simulations, which I like a lot, to get used to, you know, the tournament regime. Probably do some tactical training. Okay, I think at this level, I don't really have to maybe review some typical end games, but that's about it in terms of end games. And I don't know, that's pretty much it. Like I said, and you say it as well, at GM level, probably openings are the number one priority, because most of the other areas of the game, unless you see you have some big problem in some area of the game, you're more or less fine.
Yeah, that makes sense. So as I mentioned in the intro, you say in your Lee Chess coaches page, where there's a lot of biographical information that listeners can find about you, that you were on a Croatian TV show dedicated to chess. Obviously, I've had some Croatian guests on the show. They actually haven't interviewed, I believe, any Croatian grandmasters, but of course, the famed YouTubers Agad Matur and Hanging Pawns have both been on the show, and recent adult improver Dr. Luka Popov. And what I'm impressed with from interfacing with these Croatians, and actually I visited the country a long time ago and it's beautiful, number one, how well you guys all speak English, and number two, the chess culture. So let's hear about the television show and to sort of why you think chess is so vibrant in Croatia when the weather's so nice to begin with.
Well, okay, I think it comes back from the older days, you know, maybe 40, 50 years ago, we had some TV shows with famous grandmasters, and you know, then they passed on kind of this, you could say, chess culture to new generations. So I think that's a part of it. I mean, also chess has been popular in Croatia for quite a long time. We have good national teams, and maybe these days not that many young players. This is kind of a pity that not many young players are taking up chess seriously, at least. So that's maybe changing. I'm not sure. But definitely we have a strong chess culture in Croatia. And the TV show that I did, it's called Chess Commentary. Actually, now it's done by another grandmaster, Aloysia Jankovic. It's the, you know, we are giving comments of old games, like famous games and new games alike. And I think a lot of people who don't even play chess can, they, you know, from the reviews that I've heard, they enjoy it because they can see something. There is like a demo board, yeah, and you're moving the pieces.
Right.
And so they can see and they can enjoy it.
And there's enough interest there for a show like that to yeah, continue to be made?
Apparently, yes.
And from having been on it, did anyone ever recognize you from having been on the show? I mean, now you're in Bulgaria, so that makes it harder.
Yeah, not possible. But no, I've done it only for a limited time, maybe 7-8 months. But actually, my colleague Jankovic, I think he said that some people have recognized him. He's kind of like a TV face.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And is there much chess? Like, again, I associate Croatia with very nice weather, seaside in many places. Is there a lot of outdoor chess in Croatia?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think 2 years ago when Grand Chess Tour was in Zagreb, which, by the way, it's going to be this year as well in July. It was the weather was nice, and then Carlsen and other people, you know, in the Grand Chess Tour, they were making pictures with kids outdoors, and I think they were also playing some simuls there. So, I think, and you can see sometimes, you know, like taxi drivers and some regular people just playing chess on the street.
And what about life in Bulgaria? Now, I assume you moved there because your wife is Bulgarian.
Yes. It's I'm not very active in terms of, you know, like chess life, so it's mostly like a base, and I do most of my stuff online. But just living in Bulgaria, it's kind of a similar culture, and I've learned the language, so I feel pretty comfortable.
And is your Bulgarian as good as your English?
That's a good question. My English is better, I think.
Okay, and do you speak any other languages?
That's about it, I think.
I mean, three's more than I can say. And again, your English is so impressive. Which, of course, you did study in the States. Could you tell us a little bit about that experience? Going to university in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, it was a nice opportunity when I was getting out of high school, and I thought, okay, why not? I studied at University of Texas at Dallas for 4 years. I got my undergrad degree in business administration. And then there was another opportunity. At that time, Susan Polgar was at the Texas Tech University, and she invited me for, you know, to join their chess program. And I enrolled also in business school there. So I got my master's degree in finance and made my GM norm.
Excellent. Yeah. GM title. Yeah. You're very hard earned GM title, as you detail in the book. I read that you had gotten your master's in finance at Texas Tech, but I missed that you were at UTD, which obviously I've interviewed some other people there. What other titled players were there while you were at UTD?
Actually, this was a very, I could say, strong generation, because I think John Bartholomew was the same generation as me, Alejandro Ramirez. A couple of Serbian IMs, it was a very strong, you know, we had, I think Alejandro was the only GM, but we had a lot of IMs, a lot of FMs, and many other players, of course, in the chess team. So I think we always fielded two teams for the Pan American Championships.
Okay. So obviously John Bartholomew, but Dmitry Schneider.
Dmitry was there. He was Zaremba. There before. Zaremba, yeah. Yes.
Nice. He's a good friend of mine. Good stuff. So last thing, Davorin, what are you up to these days? Like outside of chess, what are your interests?
Okay. I like to do sports. I used to play football, when I was much younger, but, don't have that much opportunity anymore, but yeah, typically any sports, swimming, whatever I can do. And, just watching sports, I think that's the main thing I waste my time on. So.
And with you being so strong and your wife being so strong, I of course have to ask about whether your kid is or will be playing chess.
Well, okay, she's throwing pieces around.
Okay.
It's a start.
Yeah. How old is she?
She knows two years old.
Oh, yeah. So
it's too early, I think. I think most people start at, I don't know, 4 or 5.
Yeah, I think six is ideal, but the go-getters start earlier. I've had
some students even 5 years old, I think.
Yeah, it depends. Depends on the kid. But,
depends on the kid.
Yeah, somewhere in that range for sure. And again, this is deeply covered in your book, but I can't let you go, being that I was struck by how incredibly well-read you are in the field of chess and even beyond chess. If you could rattle off a few of your favorite books, chess or otherwise.
Yeah, so the books that probably have made the most impact on me when I was younger were Alexander Kotov's Think Like a Grandmaster and Shereshevsky's Endgame Strategy. And I'd say from the newer books, I like books by Boris Gelfand and obviously by Dvoretsky. Also Jacob Agard's books. But there's so many good books, really, it's hard to, you know, pick.
We could
talk all day about it.
Yeah, tons of recommendations and suggestions.
I provided some recommendations in the book, yeah, for each study area and for study levels and things like that.
Yeah, and hearing you mention Shereshevsky's classic Endgame Strategy, it actually, one more chess point that I would like listeners to be aware of is the point you made about, like, because a lot of people talk about studying endgames, of course, but stuff like 100 Endgames You Must Know and Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual sometimes can be dry. So I liked the analogy you made of comparing a endgame manual to a car manual. Could you explain that for our listeners?
Yeah, because sometimes people feel like they should read the whole Dvoretsky's Endgame Manual, you know, in one go and things like that. But, you know, it's a manual, so it's something to be used when you need it. And it's not something that's meant to be necessarily studied as a block. But you can spread it out in different study projects. You know, maybe you study some types of bishop endgames, opposite color bishop endgames for a month, and then you stop, and then you study something else. And I made this analogy with the car manual because, I mean, who reads car manuals from first to the last page? So why would you do it with the endgame book? I mean, endgames are studied, it takes time, yeah? It takes a lot of time. You have to analyze your own games where you had endgames. You have to analyze other games, know your theoretical endgames, obviously. But it takes time. You cannot just learn endgames by reading an endgame manual. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah, which I was reassured by because, as I've mentioned before on the podcast, I enjoy reading books like Endgame Strategy or Gelfand's Endgame books. But when they do get too technical, I do feel like the odds that I'm going to, like the number of times I would need to drill the position to actually remember it at the time, like it just feels like kind of like a parlay bet. Like it's just not super likely to happen. So,
yeah. You have to, I think everything you do in chess, you should take it as, you know, this race between a rabbit or a hare and a turtle. You mm-hmm. should be the turtle, yeah, because you should take it slowly and over time, because I talk about this in the first chapter about learning processes that our brains need time to, especially chess is such a complex game that a lot of it is subconscious. And people want, when they study chess a lot of time, they want to see this cause and effect. Well, I studied this, so I'm going to learn that, yeah? And I'm going to get this skill or this kind of knowledge. And they always want to see that. And they don't really appreciate the long-term kind of study where subconsciously you pick up things. And this is something I stress in the book a lot, and I hope that the readers will get that from the book.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think that that's a good note to wrap things up on, Davorin. The book is How to Study Chess on Your Own, Creating a Plan That Works and Sticking to It. And of course, again, available in paper form, Kindle, New in Chess Reader app. And did you say it's on Forward Chess as well, Devin?
Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah. So lots of ways to read it. Again, the chess material itself, very challenging, but very rewarding. But the study plans and the general guidance, I think, could be useful for everyone. Now, Devrin, aside from the book, how is there a way for people best to keep up with whatever? I know you said you have lots of book ideas with whatever you unveil in the future.
Well, I'm sorry. Can you just kind of rephrase the question?
Yeah. What is the best way for listeners to follow what you're doing? Could your reach you through the Lee Chess Coaches page, or is there another way?
Yeah, I mean, that's on Lee Chess or on chess.com. I have my coaching page. I'm not too active on social media. That's so you won't find me there too much. But on these pages, yeah, you can get in touch with me if you liked.
Okay, yeah, that's how I found Devrin. So his story checks out. Excellent. All right. Well, Devrin, keep up the amazing work. These books are so good. So I hope you have more in the future. And I would love to talk chess improvement again with you someday.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure.
Thanks, as always, to my producer, Matthew Passy. Thanks to you all for listening. And thanks to those of you who help spread the word, whether it be positive reviews on podcast platforms, telling friends, social media, all that stuff helps get the word out, and it is much appreciated. By the way, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at BennyFishel1. You can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group to continue the conversation, sometimes even with that week's guests. The Perpetual Chess Instagram page is back in action as well, at Perpetual Chess. And you can also find all these links on the Perpetual Chess webpage, perpetualchesspod.com. But of course, the main purpose of these closing credits is to thank everyone who supports Perpetual Chess financially. Without you all, we would not be able to put out such a consistent and hopefully quality product. So thanks so much. It really means the world to me. And in particular, I would like to give thanks to the following people and entities, starting off with my friends at chessable.com. Aside from that, I would like to thank David Lazarus of lasmanchess.com. He is the coach of Dave's Young Tigers on Lee Chess, our friends at Quality Chess Books, the Capital City Chess Club, the Abysmal Depths of Chess blog, Adapta Interactive Web Designs and Services, the Apprend Chess Twitch channel, A Needy Deer, Austin Clough, Benjamin Porto, Bill Sigler, Kathy Carr, Chad Oliver, the Charlotte Chess Center, the Chess Essentials Chess blog, chessmood.com, Chris Flanagan, Chris Lott, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel He, Danny Davidson, David Schreiber, I am Dimitri Schneider, I am Eric Rosen, Eric Tam, Ewan Richardson, Farhan Thawar, Faraz Sawaf, Gary Foreman, Glenn Downing, Greg Harfst, Greg Shahadi, Gregory Gulick, Guvin Manet, James Holyhead, James Kennedy, Jeff Martinson, Jens Green, Jeremy Nielsen, John Jernigan, John Rockefeller, John MacArthur, Kelly Palmer, Kevin O'Callaghan, King Selt, the King's Crusher YouTube channel, one of the original chess YouTube channels, Lucio Casada Silva, the law offices of Stuart Katz, Matthew Feeney, Michael Kahn, FM Michael Oblin, Mike Zelazny, Mr. Mike Shahadi, the legendary Mr. Dodgy, the Nerdnase Twitch channel, GM Peter Prohaska, Peter Sodhi, the Playmore Chess Academy of the Hamden Chess Club, Reuven Fisher, Reverend Roy Fry, the Seattle Chess Club, Shane Unger, Stefan Kelty, Stephen Martinez, Sven Gearson, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Todd Bryant of Strong Chess, Todd Kennedy, the Vintage Patzers, which is a chess.com improver group. You can look them up. Wayne Beam, William Hogarth, and I also would like to thank Aaron Waffler, Ace Viega, Adam Ralph of chessengland.com, Adrian Gutierrez, Al Hastings, Alan and Maggie Sue, Alex Pejas, Alexander Markovics, Antonio Cancino, FM Andre Tarakov, Dr. Andrew Perry, Angus McLeod, Barry Hessian, Bill Juniper, Bill Moran, Bill Trammell, Brad and Andy Rosen, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Chase, Brian Mullis, Bruce Scott, Brian Tillis of Palm Beach Chess, Cameron Davis, Chad Hilton, Chess Potzer Spain, Dr. Charles Snodgrass, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Wood, I am Christoph Zalecki, also known as Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Corey Butson, Costa Carras, Courtney Fry, Craig Mallon, Daniel Ginsberg, Daniel Naylor, Dave Saylor, David Bleskacek, David Brown, David Hamblin, David Cramley, Dalen Shelton, Dennis Parrish, Dirk Decker, FM Donnie Ariel, Dwayne Edmonds, Ed Daly, Ed Mead, Emmanuel Langual, Robitaille, Ethan Smith, Hallelujah Cat, Ian Mason, Fide Arbiter, Felipe Melo Pereira, Fox Valley Chess Club, Francis Letart Lavoie, Dr. Frank Tortoris, Frank Zananis, Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Gautam Narula, Geert Vandervelde, Gene Stewart, George Harris, Giovanni Russo, Han Schutt, Harish Srinivasan, Howard Vihan, Jacob Kovach, Jason Apollo, Jason Murray, Jacques Parry, James Aspinwall, James Benastia, James Muir, Jason Woolham, Jadeep Chakrabarty, Jeff Anderson, Jeffrey Martello, Yep Hoyland, Jerry Wells, Jesse DeCumos, Jesse McNulty, Jim Ratliff, Joe DeSano, Joe Valdez, Joel Thomas Ramos, John Tooley, Juan Almaguar, Dr. John Fallon, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman of U.S. Chess, John Jeffrey, John McMurtry, Jonathan Slater, John Quist, John Tully, Jose Rodriguez, Justin Gardner, Jen Shahadi, Joel Rocky, John Thompson, GM Josh Friedel, IM Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, Kevin Pryor, IM Kostya Kovutsky of the Chess Dojo, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Kyle McAvoy, Larry Cook, Larry Reiforth, Laura Belyavsky, Macaulay Peterson, Mark Fitzpatrick, Mark Miller, Mark Wilkins, Marco Bulatovich, Martin Knudsen, Martin Krug, Matthew Passy, Matthew Tedesco of SeattleChessMeetup.org, Matthias Plock, Mechanics Institute Chess Club of San Francisco, Michael Allard, Michael Hudson, Mike Clem, Mitchell Fabian, Nate Gobel, Nate Solon, Neil Bruce, Nigmat Malijanov, Nicholas Isabel, Olaf Mueller Michaels, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Queenside Management Limited in Switzerland, Randy Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Richard Hollenbach, Richard Tucker, Robert Callahan, Robert Tichy, Robert Turner, Rory Coleman, Rory Yearwood, Ryan Berg, the Say Chess YouTube channel, Scott McKinnon, Scott Shepard, Sean Krause, Sebastian Finsterwater, Walter, Sergey Magakon, Seth Ruzicka, Shane Unger, Silver Knights in Richmond, Stefan Roller, WGM Tatyav Abrahamian, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, FM Timothy Wall, Tom Edsel, Tomas Komanich, Tony Rattel, Tyron Price, Vishnu Srikumar, William Brock, William Peterson, FM Zhao Chang of Chess1000.com, and last but never least, Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks for listening, everyone, and we will catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.